alleged unlimited derivatives. But does Tim know too much?
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
All this week at this time, we're hearing about the life of William Golding, the man who wrote Lord of the Flies in John Carey's biography. The reader is Christian Rodsker.
Two terrible things happened to Golding in the 1960s. In 1967, on the afternoon of the 13th of July, he set sail from Shoreham Harbour in his boat Tenace, with his wife Anne, his daughter Judy, and three friends. They planned to sail through the Mediterranean and cruise among the Greek islands. But at 5 o'clock the next morning, they were run down in the channel by a Japanese freighter. Their boat filled with water, and Judy, for one, was sure they would die. Against all the odds, the freighter turned back, was able to find them, and picked them up. But the Tenace and all their belongings sank. The disaster had a lasting effect on Golding's confidence and self-esteem. He had built a persona around the achievement of a young naval officer in command of a ship. Now that pride and status were taken from him. In January 1969 came a still worse calamity. Golding's son, David, now 28 years old, suffered a severe nervous breakdown and was taken into hospital. He responded to treatment, but it became clear that his chances of leading a normal life were very uncertain. "I cannot describe what he has gone through," Golding wrote to his friend and editor at Faber's, Charles Monteith, "nor what we have gone through." He tried to give an account of what he felt in a manuscript he called History of a Crisis. In the aftermath of David's illness, he writes, his own existence became unendurable. Daylight had a kind of raw intensity. Nights were sleepless. The remedy he took to was drink. He can't remember how many times he was dead drunk, but it was at least once a week. Sometimes he was drunk for more than a day. He said unforgivable things to Anne and, as he guiltily phrases it, he pulled her about on at least three occasions. He would play records all night or sit at the piano drooling non-music. His GP prescribed sedatives and a course of medication for chronic alcoholism, and with Anne's help, he began to improve. But he felt he was finished as a novelist. For most of the 1970s, he could not write anything except his journal, in which he recorded each barren day. Then, towards the end of the 70s, he began two novels simultaneously. They seem in a way to reflect the two disasters that had overwhelmed him. The first is about a boy who is terribly burned in the London Blitz and leads a strange, isolated life in touch with beings from the spirit world. The boy seems partly modelled on his stricken son David, and the novel Darkness Visible, published in 1979, was a spectacular success. In America, it sold 45,000 in the first 3 months. The other novel, Rites of Passage, is set in the closing years of the Napoleonic Wars and takes place on board an old decommissioned warship carrying emigrants to Australia. The narrator of Rites of Passage is Edmund Talbot, a young man with aristocratic connections on his way to join the colonial government. His narration takes the form of a journal he's keeping at the request of his godfather, who is a nobleman. To entertain this grandee, Talbot pens amusing and condescending accounts of the other passengers. The passenger who catches his attention most is a young clergyman, Robert Colley. He is gauche and lower middle class, and Talbot finds his obsequious manners repellent. But his sense of fair play is aroused when Colley is publicly humiliated by the ship's bullying Captain Anderson. Talbot persuades Anderson to treat Colley with more respect. Unfortunately, this gives Colley the confidence to put on his ecclesiastical robes and venture into the forecastle, the part of the ship where lower class emigrants and ordinary seamen live, intending to lead them in worship. Catastrophe ensues. Raucous laughter and applause are heard, and Collie emerges drunk, scantily clad, and evidently ecstatically happy, clinging to a half-naked sailor in full view of the assembled gentlefolk. Nothing is heard of Collie in the days that follow. He lies face down in his bunk, seemingly unconscious, taking neither food nor drink. Anxiety about his condition mounts. Talbot, and even eventually Captain Anderson, enter the young clergyman's cabin and speak words of comfort. It does no good. Collie remains motionless and dies, overwhelmed by shame. On a visit to the dead man's cabin, Talbot notices some sheets of manuscript and, out of curiosity, reads them. They prove to be Collie's journal of the voyage, written as letters for his sister. By contrast with Talbot's upper-class superciliousness, what Collie has written is ablaze with romantic ardour. We could almost be reading the young Coleridge. He glories in the sun, the sea, the ship, and her bronzed young crewmen, especially a beautiful youth called Billy Rogers, whose soul, Collie tells his sister, he hopes to save. Billy Rogers was the sailor whom Collie was embracing when he emerged, drunk, from the forecastle. What happened when he was in the forecastle remains a mystery, until two other passengers tell Talbot about some gossip they've overheard among the crew. The gossip is that Billy Rogers has been boasting that he never expected to get a chew off a parson. Talbot's two informants innocently suppose that this means Collie chewed tobacco and had given some to Billy. But Talbot knows better. He realizes, as he explains rather awkwardly to his noble godfather in his journal, that Billy must have encouraged the drunken, infatuated clergyman to commit what Talbot calls the ridiculous schoolboy trick of fellatio, and that Collie died of shame when he remembered it. Golding got the idea for his story from Elizabeth Longford's biography of the Duke of Wellington, which he read in July 1974. Longford recounts that when Wellington sailed to Manila, there was a young clergyman on board the same ship who got drunk and wandered into the forecastle, where he spent a long time carousing with the crew. When he came back to his own cabin, he stayed there, neither moving nor speaking, and died of shame. Longford does not say that the clergyman performed any sexual act when he was in the forecastle, nor is there any suggestion, either in Longford or Wellington, that the clergyman was homosexual. Golding, however, saw it as a story about repressed homosexuality. Very probably, he writes in his journal, the shame that killed the chaplain on Wellington's ship was caused not by carousing, but by what he found out about his own nature. Why he felt so sure about this is impossible to say, but his journal, and especially its night-by-night accounts of his dreams, show that he was acutely aware of what he called his own homosexual component. I pretend to be immune to homosexuality and transvesticism, he writes, after dreaming of dressing up in his mother's clothes. But his unconscious tells him otherwise. My dreams won't let me get away with standard attitudes about myself, he acknowledges. A dream figure tells him, you're always trying to hide the fact that you are homosexual. His interest in repressed homosexuality may also have been aroused by what was happening to his friend Charles Monteith. Monteith was widely believed to be homosexual, though he never acknowledged it, and in the years when Golding was writing Rites of Passage, he was suffering persistent public persecution at the hands of a former friend, and perhaps former lover, called Robin Bryans. Bryans was born in Belfast, like Monteith, and published several books with Faber and Faber in the 1960s. But he evidently fell out with Monteith and arrived outside the Faber offices in Queen Square one day with a sandwich board bearing insulting slogans. Having gained entrance to the building, he threw a bulky piece of telephone equipment at Matthew Evans, who was shortly to replace Monteith as chairman of Faber's, and who was apparently the only Faber representative deemed able-bodied enough to tackle Bryans. On this occasion, Bryans was arrested but released without charge. But he began a campaign of harassment, sending lurid letters to MPs, judges and other prominent figures, denouncing Monteith as a sodomite. One was sent to Golding, who, understandably, did not reply. In April 1979, Fabers were awarded damages and Bryans was sent to prison for contempt of court after throwing a water carafe at a barrister during the hearing. The newspapers treated it all as a joke, but for Monteith, the long drawn out scandal was devastating. The fact that he'd been put through purgatory on account, if Bryans was to be believed, of his sexual nature, which he was ashamed to acknowledge, can hardly have failed to influence Golding's decision to write a novel about homosexuality and shame. Once Golding settled on his story, we can tell from his journal, his characters and their situation began to absorb him. Several critics were to comment on the vividness with which he depicts life on a late 18th century sailing ship. In fact, Golding knew little about this. He always avoided doing research for his novels, preferring to trust his imagination. But he felt he ought to do some specialised reading in naval history for rites of passage and decided to join the London Library. This foray into the world of scholarship was not a success. When he visited the library, he felt shy among the learned-looking types and could not understand the catalogues. He found three promising titles in a subject index, and choosing, he recalls, the smallest, most bespectacled and most mousy girl among the assistants, he asked her whether a figure 4 followed by a small O, like a degree sign, meant that the book was on the fourth floor. She replied with what seemed to him fairly well-disguised contempt that the sign meant quarto and referred to the size of the book. Collapse of elderly novelist disguised as a scholar was Golding's comment. He could not find any of the three books, so went to the Athenaeum Library, but failed there too. Eventually, he gave up and had dinner with Angus Wilson and his partner Tony, who happened to be in the club. That was the end of his specialised research for rites of passage. When the Booker Prize shortlist was announced in September, Golding's novel was on it. The winner would be announced on the 21st of October at a reception in Stationers' Hall, and by the 20th of October, Rites of Passage was joint favourite with Anthony Burgess's Earthly Powers. Golding set aside part of the 20th for trying to tie his black tie, as he always had to, and he arrived with Anne at Brown's Hotel on the afternoon of the 21st, wishing the whole thing was over and done with. Under stress of this kind, his fight against alcoholism sometimes faltered. John Spears, the publisher of J.L. Carr, another shortlisted author, was at the Stationers' Hall that night. "I went to the loo with Jim," he recalls, "and William Golding, who clearly had a lot to drink, came in and fell flat on his face." Claire Tomlin, one of the judges, was standing next to Golding when the chairman, David Dykes, announced the winner. It was Rites of Passage, and she saw tears spring into Golding's eyes. His own record of the evening in his journal is lacking in detail. "Goodness me, what a night at the Stationers' Hall," he wrote. Perhaps his memory of it was rather blurred.
Christian Rodsker was reading the fourth part of John Carey's biography, William Golding, The Man Who Wrote Lord of the Flies. It was adapted by John Carey and produced by Bruce Young. Well, the last chapter sees another win,